us an update on Scott Valley groundwater study. Mr. Brian McFadden.
Good afternoon, Chairman Norin, members of the board.
Rascal.
Rascal.
I'm back before you to discuss another component of Scott River TMDL implementation. I think you're all familiar with the sometimes contentious nature of Scott TMDL implementation, but today I have the pleasure of introducing a presentation by Dr. Harder on an element of TMDL implementation in Scott Valley that's going really well, the Scott Valley Groundwater Study. This board is interested in groundwater in Scott Valley because during the development of the temperature TMDL for Scott River, we recognized and identified the tremendous importance of groundwater in influencing temperatures of Scott River and some tributaries. I mentioned that this process is going really well, and there are a number of reasons from my perspective why that is, and I'll just highlight a few of them. The community has stepped up in a big way and collected information and has been involved all along the way, but actually approached Dr. Harder directly about, regarding his involvement and got him involved in the watershed. The county stepped up in a big way and led the effort to develop the groundwater study plan, which was the only element related to groundwater in the Scott TMDL implementation plan, established a groundwater advisory committee that has been really instrumental in providing information and feedback to Dr. Harder and his team. The Resource Conservation District, Siskiyou Resource Conservation District, has stepped up in a big way and applied for and received 319H grant dollars that are implementing many of the recommendations of Dr. Harder to fill data gaps and develop the understanding that's necessary. And on that note, I want to just briefly recognize a member of your staff, Bernadette Reed, who's in the audience today, who manages that grant and has done a stellar job with that. The TMDL contract dollars that we've applied to it, as well as the state board's funding of this ongoing work, has been it's what's made this effort possible, and I'm really thankful that the state board stepped up and helped us out when we ran out of TMDL contract dollars to keep it going. And finally, we're really fortunate to have the involvement of the UC Cooperative Extension, and particularly Steve Orloff, who's the farm advisor in Siskiyou County and is an expert in irrigation and alfalfa, but particularly Dr. Harder. His role in this process really can't be understated. He's brought technical prowess and expertise, but also integrity. And that's inspired confidence in all of the parties involved with the process, and that confidence and trust is often hard to come by, and just absolutely important. And before I ask Dr. Harder to come up and present to you his work, I just want to give you a little anecdote of something that illustrated to me just how well this was going, or this is going. Just after Thanksgiving of this year, we had a groundwater advisory committee meeting, and Dr. Harder and Laura, a member of his team, and myself were all present. And the setting was, Dr. Harder had done some work. There was some disagreement about some of the numbers used, and prior to this meeting, that issue had been identified, and data was collected through the 319H grant by the RCD to understand that issue better and provide locally collected and derived data to plug that data gap. And there we were in the Fort Jones Community Center, which I know some of you have been, sitting around the table with water users and other members of the community, with Dr. Orloff and his data that he'd collected with the 319H funds and in cooperation with the RCD, and we're figuring this stuff out. And I sat there and I had to just kind of suppress a little chuckle and shake my head, because in 2007, if somebody had told me that I would be in that situation and the community would have taken the lead and the county had taken the lead and we'd be so far along, I would have said they're crazy. You know, it was just better than I could have imagined. And it's going well. Clearly, there's going to be conflict and difficult conversations ahead on the topic. But I think you'll see from Dr. Harder's presentation that what's evolved is, or is evolving, we're not done yet, is a great tool to investigate those issues. That's one. And two, which, you know, it's not going to come out in the presentation, but the buy-in by the community that this affects, that the information that's being developed has validity and credibility. And so my hope is when those difficult conversations come about, that the topic won't be related to the science, but more the policy and what are the solutions. And then the tool that Dr. Harder is developing will aid us in working through those issues. And so with that, I'd like to call up Dr. Harder. I should also mention he has a whole team behind him that works with him, and I can't introduce all of them, but I'm sure he will. I know he has a slide for that. So I wanted to acknowledge that it's not just him. It's a number of people that are working on this issue at the UC Davis. And so with that, I'd like to introduce Dr. Thomas Harder, who's the UC Cooperative Extension Groundwater Program Director and Principal Investigator of the Scott Valley Groundwater Study.
Thank you. Thank you, Brian. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, my name is Thomas Harder. University of California, Davis. I'm the Robert M. Hagen Chair of Water Management Policy. I say that with pride, since Dr. Hagen did much of this type of work 20, 30 years ago. I'm also a member of the Board of Directors of the Groundwater Resource Association. This work that I'm presenting today, the presentation was prepared by Laura Folia and myself, but as Brian mentioned, the research group really is much larger. We have a number of students working on this. Brian mentioned Steve Orloff. He's the director for Siskiyou County Cooperative Extension. Blaine Hansen is one of our irrigation specialists. Rick Snyder is our climate specialist. Colleagues of mine in at UC Davis. And I also want to recognize the help that we've received from the many sites that are participating in the process in Scott Valley. That includes Siskiyou County, Rick Costales, and others. It includes the Groundwater Advisory Committee and the Watershed Committee, the Watershed Council in Scott Valley. Sari Sommerstrom has been hugely helpful in explaining a lot of the scientific issues going on in the Scott Valley. Funding comes from the State Water Board. And so that's really sets the stage, and I'm just one of the people working on this. Brian already mentioned, I'm still trying to figure this out here with which direction this goes. It goes forward? Okay, got it. All right. And is there a pointer in the middle?
At the top.
Okay, got it. So I'm going to just today go over sort of where did we start from? Where have we come? What are sort of the elements of pieces that we have pulled together, and where is it going to go? I don't think I need to explain the situation there very much. Some of you have been there. This is really about stream flow and protection of fish, and it's both the flow and the temperature that we're concerned about in the Klamath, and to the degree that groundwater and groundwater levels support stream flow in the summer, this is really about the connection between groundwater and surface water. One thing that it's not about that's really important is it's not about the Scott Valley being overdrafted, groundwater in the Scott Valley being overdrafted. We're far from an overdraft situation. The water level program that is being implemented in Scott Valley through a private citizen-based monitoring program clearly shows that in the long run, over the last 6 years, which is about how long this monitoring program has gone on, we don't see any long-term trends, downward trends, across the board in the Scott Valley. Generally, what we see are seasonal variations in water levels, with higher water levels in the winter and lower water levels in the summer. But there's not a general downward trend in this data series. There's some wells that go down, some wells that go up, but overall, groundwater generally, that groundwater basin could be thought of as being relatively full, since it does discharge into the Scott River. And that's the way we want to keep it. What is an issue is that between when I push that light button, something happens that's not supposed to happen. Let me try again. Yeah. Which one is the light? Is the top the light or the middle? Top is the light. Maybe that's my mistake. Okay, I apologize. Let's try that one more time. There. I think I got it. Okay. Okay, cool. So sometime between, we had in the early part of the second half of the 20th century, we had two major droughts in the early mid-40s and then another one in the early mid-50s. And then really a drought-free period until the drought in 1977. These are normalized flows on the Scott River at the Scott River stream gauge below the Scott Valley. And it was only in that 1977 drought and subsequent droughts that during summer periods we saw extremely low flows on the Scott River, much, much lower than we have seen in the early part of the stream gauging record, which goes back to 1941, and which is relatively complete. What I see here is this is not so much a trend as it is a change in regime of the summer flows on the Scott River, which happened sometime between this drought in the early 1950s and this first drought in the late 1970s. And what happened in that time is we converted a lot of the flood irrigation-only agriculture in the Scott Valley to sprinkler irrigations with wheel lines, and in the last 10 years in a lot of places also with center pivots. The question is what is the relationship between starting that groundwater pumping that is being used for feeding a lot of these wheel lines and now the center pivots and these low flows in the Scott River? So the idea behind this, as Brian said, is let's bring together the science, let's bring together the data in a framework that's technically based and that's scientific based that can help us pull together what we understand, that can help us identify data gap, that provides a basis for a dialogue about policies on how to move forward, a basis that all stakeholders can agree upon, and that can also be used as a tool to evaluate any management strategies that we may be thinking of, or our stakeholders may be thinking of, in going forward and looking at whether or not these strategies may or may not be useful. And so, as some of the previous speakers said, this is really about putting a tool together that will be part of an adaptive management approach that also is nimble, and much in the way that we've seen in the other work that was just presented on the Klamath. And I was really inspired by Governor Brown's State of the State address this morning. He quoted an Irish poet in speaking about education, and I think this quote fits really well for much of what's happening here, not just in terms of education, but the outreach and the dialogue that happens between all the different stakeholders, including you as the regulatory agency. The quote that he gave was, education, and you can replace this with outreach, dialogue. Dialogue is not just about filling a pail. It's about lighting a fire. And I think that's part of what this process is. It's a tool, but it's also about that dialogue that we have and the understanding that we create that really engages the various stakeholders rather than just putting them in place. So we started with the groundwater study plan in 2008, which sort of set the framework. It was a summary of what do we know about the Scott Valley from a land use perspective, hydrological perspective, geological perspective, and soils perspective. It identified an agenda for research that could be done to better understand the groundwater-surface-water interaction, with one of the key recommendations to develop a database and that can then be used to develop a groundwater-surface-water modeling tool. Much of that and the subsequent activities were, as I mentioned earlier, a collaborative approach with regional board, with the Groundwater Advisory Committee, Watershed Council. And we have many different agencies involved as well, the RCD, USDA, NRCS, Forest Service, Fish and Wildlife are all part of this and have all contributed in one way or another. We have, over the past 4 years, compiled an extensive database. We've, in the last year, have revised and revisited a lot of our data that we've pulled together to build the groundwater model. We have rebuilt a very comprehensive water budget for the valley, and I'll talk about this here in a minute, and used that to develop a sort of a precursor to the groundwater model that can help us understand in principle, not in its exact magnitude, but in principle, the interaction between groundwater pumping and stream flow in the Scott River. And we're in the middle of now using those data and building this groundwater model. And over the next year, we'll be calibrating this groundwater surface water model for the Scott Valley and identifying a limited number of scenarios that we would then use this model with to look at alternative management practices and how they may improve summer stream flows on the Scott River. So let me talk a little bit about the data collection effort that we've pulled together on this. Starting with precipitation data, and I just told Mike Diaz, I never thought that you could sweat so many hours over just pulling together a precipitation record for an area that's not overly large. It's not small, but it's not like the Central Valley where I do a lot of my other work. We've spent quite a bit of time looking at different precipitation records, partly driven by observations of locals that said, you know, on the west side of the Scott Valley, there's a lot more precipitation than on the east side. This is specifically on the valley floor. We've looked at data that we've found from on California agency sites. We've looked at recently revamped website of the National Oceanographic Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, and we've compared these data, and there's about four stations with significant records, two that have a very long record going back to the 1940s, Callahan and Fort Jones, Callahan down here, Fort Jones up there. And then on the west side, we have Greenview and we have Etna. Greenview, Fort Jones, and Callahan have all very similar precipitation. Etna precipitation is quite a bit higher, although a closer look at the record led us to think that perhaps there is a bias in this record. Based on where the station is and how the station is constructed. And it's much, much shorter time record than the first two. And even if that is correct, this higher precipitation seems to impact really just the way outer margin of this valley. So based on these three stations, and mostly these two stations, we concluded that, at least for the time being, we don't have a data record that would permit us to say there is a spatially variable precipitation across the valley floor and that we have data to recognize that. So for all modeling purposes, at least, we're going to assume that precipitation across the valley floor is uniform and that it corresponds to the average of these two stations for Jones and Callan, for which we have the longest records. We've done a significant amount of work on stream flow data. We do have very good data on the outlet, on the Scott River at the outlet of the valley. We have sporadic data on various tributaries to the Scott River, for which we developed a regression equation. So using the regression model, we have now at least estimated data on tributary stream flows into the Scott Valley that will become part of the groundwater surface water model. Now this doesn't want to work at all. Let me try this. This is just a pointer. Now it's giving up. There we go. We have assembled land use data, starting with the Department of Water Resources Land Use Survey of 2000 and then 2001, which was a drought year, a fairly extensive database. And we have updated that land use map with information that we were provided with by the Groundwater Advisory Council through a couple meetings that we had last year. We've simplified the land use for groundwater modeling purposes into essentially four categories. We have fields on which alfalfa is grown in rotation with grain. A typical rotation is 7 years of alfalfa and 1 year of grain. And this is mostly for the health of the alfalfa and for soil quality reasons. That's the typical rotation up there. And so what you see in yellow on this map, those are fields that have alfalfa, and every eighth year they will have grain. And that eighth year with grain is sort of randomly distributed throughout that yellow area. The green area are areas in Scott Valley where we have pasture. Pasture mostly being surface water irrigated through flood irrigation, with some exceptions. Then we have an area down on the south where we have the mine dredge tailings, where we have neither irrigation nor any kind of ET over a very large area because it's essentially a barren land surface. And then we have areas, especially in the Quartz Valley and here on the west side of Scott Valley, where we have basically natural vegetation, and then also along the river, smaller areas, riparian areas, where you have natural vegetation, which will depend on groundwater and or on precipitation, but is not irrigated. There will be evapotranspiration, but no irrigation to meet that evapotranspiration. We've looked at irrigation types and pumping wells. A student that was working on this project initially and actually built the first groundwater model did a summer worth of field work on collecting data on wells from the Department of Water Resources, identifying their locations partly through review of records, partly through field review and field validation. We have about 170 or so irrigation wells in the valley that we've identified. We have, from the Department of Water Resources and through information from the Groundwater Advisory Committee, information on the type of irrigation and whether or not on any given field water will be applied strictly from surface water sources, strictly from groundwater resources, or from a mix of surface water and groundwater resources. So we have information on the irrigation type as well as on the source of the irrigation. We have information on the water holding capacity of the soil based on the soil survey. That essentially gives us an idea of how much water can be contributed from the soil column alone towards meeting the crop water demand. In dark blue here, you see areas that have fairly high water holding capacity, exceeding 8 inches in the upper 6 or 5 feet. Most of the area has water holding capacity that's just under 8 inches. And then at the margins where we have the coarser soils, we typically see relatively low water holding capacity. So we use these data in what we call a soil water root zone model that we then will couple with the That was not the right direction I wanted to go. Let's try this again. With the groundwater model. So independent from the groundwater model, we've developed using these data a root zone water budget model that for the entire area of the Scott Valley on individual fields on a daily basis looks at water and water routing through the root zone, which includes precipitation application to the field, irrigation applications to the field, the evapotranspiration from the field, and how much of the irrigation would be from groundwater pumping versus how much of the irrigation would be from surface water. That allows us to also calculate what the pumping rate is in individual fields on any given day, at least theoretically. And it allows us to estimate what the recharge is to groundwater from individual fields. So here's a map of the average annual amount of irrigation in Scott Valley. You see the darker the color, the higher the irrigation amount. Most of the irrigation is sort of along the river in the central part of the valley. Less irrigation out here. A lot of this area on the west side is actually fed directly by groundwater. There's much less irrigation happening here. Areas that are surface water irrigated, they have a lot of irrigation while surface water is available, and then once surface water is curtailed because of low summer flows, that irrigation on pasture usually stops. If you look at pumping, this is the part of the irrigation that comes from groundwater pumping. Most of the pumping happens along or in the vicinity of the Scott River and also in the vicinity of Moffett Creek. You can see this area, there's essentially no pumping in here because this is either surface water irrigated or directly fed from a very shallow groundwater table. There's not much pumping going on down here. Most of the pumping really happens in this area. So this is coming. These are data not measured, but these come directly out of our modeling efforts. When we look at When we look at recharge, this is again from the modeling. This is the amount of recharge that happens throughout Scott Valley and its spatial variability across the valley. Again, this is the average annual recharge. We have. And then we can calculate what's the net contribution across the valley to groundwater. And on this image, you see the central part that shows up sort of as brown and yellow colors. This is where there's a net abstraction of groundwater over the course of the year, whereas these areas that are blue and green have essentially a net contribution to groundwater. Most of the groundwater that's abstracted in this central yellow area is replaced essentially from stream flow, and much of the stream flow really that comes in the wetter winter months. When we look at the dynamics over time, not just over space but over time, and we look at different water years, what we see is that in dry years we have the amount of ET that, this is for the root zone box if you want, if I take the root zone across the entire Scott Valley, the losses out of the root zone to ET are somewhat stable over time, but the losses to recharge are very little in dry years and much higher in wet years because we have a lot more surface water irrigation in wet years that then contribute to recharge to groundwater. You can see that here on the right-hand side, the gains to the root zone come from precipitation in blue, from applied groundwater in green, and from surface water, applied surface water in light blue. When we have these really wet years, indicated by these blue arrows, those are the years when we also have a lot of groundwater recharge. When we look at it between alfalfa fields and pasture fields, there's very different dynamics. Alfalfa uses a lot of groundwater. Most alfalfa fields are irrigated with groundwater. Many of them are under center pivots. With very little surface water used and very little differences actually between wet years and dry years. Drier years tend to have a higher application of water, typically because the irrigation season starts much earlier. On pasture, groundwater use is relatively constant. Most of the irrigation comes from surface water, which will depend largely on whether we're in a wet year or whether we're in dry years. On average, this water budget model for the root zone estimates that for alfalfa, we have about 32 inches per year of irrigation. For grain, it's much less. They take the grain out in the middle of July. It's about 13 inches of irrigation, and on pasture, about 25 inches of irrigation. These are the estimated crop ET values under optimal irrigation, whereas this would be the actual ET calculated by the model, with the difference referred to as what we call deficiency. This deficiency for alfalfa is mostly because alfalfa irrigation stops in early September, late August, and there's deficiency in alfalfa ET that occurs in September and October. For pasture, pasture is often, especially in dry years, not irrigated once surface water is no longer available, and so there's actually a much larger deficiency. We have numbers for recharge and pumping, as I mentioned earlier. One of the things that we found from this effort, and this is very critical, and this kind of was alluded to by Brian, and it figures into this process working with the local growers. The irrigation amount that we found from the model, these 32 inches, really are much different from what the growers reported to us before we even begin modeling that they are applying on an annual basis on alfalfa and grains. They are estimating that depending on whether they use center pivots or wheel lines, that they're applying somewhere between 18 and 22 inches, maybe 23 inches of irrigation water, whereas we are estimating that they're using about 32 inches. When we initially found out this discrepancy earlier last year, Steve Orloff with Blaine Hansen and Rick Snyder volunteered to actually implement some field studies that we began last summer, and we hope to redo this coming summer to look at what is actually the amount of irrigation used on alfalfa. They have 8 fields that they're measuring on, that they're measuring the actual amount of irrigation on with flow meters, where they're doing climate measurements to also check on our ET data and whether our ET data are correct. They're looking at soil moisture measurements to see to which degree the alfalfa actually feeds from soil moisture or whether there is potentially uptake directly from groundwater. And what we're hoping is that this field work will ultimately lead to some answers on why we have that discrepancy. The initial results that came out of last summer's work indicated that, let's see if I can go back here, indicated that, in fact, the irrigation amount is between 18 and 22 inches. And so we're still left with figuring out why growers can get away with so much less irrigation and still get a fairly healthy alfalfa crop, whether there's in fact a lower amount of ET or whether the other possibility is that there's some direct uptake from groundwater, although the initial soil moisture data don't indicate that there is direct uptake from groundwater. So this is an issue that we need to look into and collect additional data, and that'll be very important in driving the groundwater model. When we look at overall budgets over the course of the year, so we've looked at variation in space, we've looked at variation from year to year. Now we can look at also seasonal variations. We get a lot of recharge in winter months. We get a lot of recharge in summer months, especially on pasture, which is flood irrigated. But we also have a lot of pumping, with pumping being focused on alfalfa and grain. Grain, you don't have much pumping past July because it's harvested. Most of the pumping in July and August really is focused on the alfalfa area in Scott Valley. We use this information to then feed it into a sort of an oversimplified groundwater model, if you want to call it that. We call it a, if I can forward this. Now it does all of them at once. That's not what I wanted. We use this information to develop what we call a stream depletion function model. This is, instead of using a complex built computer model, this is essentially an analytical mathematical equation that we can pull together in a spreadsheet and couple to information about individual fields and individual wells. And what we do with this simple analytical tool is we calculate we do this kind of a graph on each one of the fields in Scott Valley. So each one of the fields that you can identify here with these little boundaries, for each field in each month, we calculate the net between recharge and pumping. So basically we call recharge negative pumping and we call real pumping positive pumping. We calculate the sum of the two, which will give us a net groundwater usage. And that net groundwater usage is then assigned to the nearest well, to each field. And then we look at the distance of the well to the Scott River. And we can use this, what's called a stream depletion function, to calculate how soon will that net pumping actually affect stream flow. This is a model that that works under very, very simplified assumption, a horizontal aquifer with uniform hydraulic conductivity and fully penetrating river. Lots of simplifying assumption, but it has embedded in it the principal physics of putting a stress on a well, using a well or having a well that puts stress on an aquifer at some distance from a river that's connected to that aquifer. And it gives us an idea of both the magnitude and the time delay that happens when you start pumping and when that would affect stream flows and how much it affects stream flows. So when you put water into that well, you're going to get eventually some positive contribution to stream flow. When you extract water out of that well, eventually you're going to extract that water out of that stream. And so what we've done is, for one, we've calculated a number that identifies the time delay. The blue numbers indicate that the wells have a very immediate impact on stream flow. Within a few days, they'll impact stream flows. Green wells, it'll be on the order of weeks. And then when we go further away to yellow wells and red wells, the delay to stream of the impact to stream flow is going to be even longer. This shows a graph that shows, again here, this is this what we call stream depletion function, which is sort of the delay function. Wells that are over here with this SDF function on the order of a few days, those are the wells that are going to affect the streams the most. When wells are in this region of a few hundred, the effect will be within weeks, and once the wells are outside of this 1,000 zone, the effects will be only months later. What is the importance of this? The importance of this is that the Scott River has about a 2 to 3 month period where it's at critically low flows in July, August, and September. And the key to managing those low flows is to manage whatever has an impact on that river within that 2 to 3 month period. So if a well is far away and pumps a lot of water in the summer, and its effect wouldn't be felt on the Scott River until later in the fall or in the winter, it doesn't really matter because the Scott River has a lot of water in the fall and the winter. But if a well is relatively close to the river and impacts the river within a week or 2 weeks or a month, then that would have an impact. And so this gives us a tool to start looking at how can we manage water potentially different or manage groundwater different. And part of this is, too, to provide this as a tool to work with the Groundwater Advisory Committee and with locals and give them an insight on how the system works. And it helps us guide our efforts later when we have this more complex groundwater model and say, okay, this is indicating we should go march sort of in this direction. Maybe we'll model a scenario that goes in that direction and see how it works out when we have all of the complexity built together. This just kind of gives us a marching direction. So the other piece that I should explain here, so there's a lot of wells that are close to the river, and some of the wells that pump the most water are very close to the river. And so those are the ones that we would be most concerned about in terms of having impact on Scott River flows. Those would be the ones that could potentially be looked at in terms of managing groundwater differently, perhaps taking some of this water in July and August and either reducing the pumping or taking pumping away altogether and supply that water from wells that are further out here. So it's not about ceasing the irrigation necessarily, but moving where water comes from for the fields that are irrigated with those wells. That's an idea that is one idea that could come out of this and could be evaluated with this. All right. Let me see. I can't get the light off. There we go. So if this is going to cooperate with me, the lighter doesn't want to come off. I must have pushed all of this too hard. There we go. So we've actually developed a whole bunch of different scenarios with this toolbox, with this very simple tool, to look at how over the course of a year, of a typical water year, how much water would be abstracted from the Scott River, that's above the black line, or how much water would be contributed to the river by the total set of wells that we have in the Scott Valley. And these scenarios, some of these scenarios just look at the parameters that we feed the model, the hydraulic conductivity of the aquifer. It's very sensitive to the hydraulic conductivity of the aquifer. These three dashed lines are three different hydraulic conductivity values that sort of span the range of hydraulic conductivities that we think apply to the Scott value. So hydraulic conductivity, it is an important number, and knowing that it's so sensitive, that impact or that connection is that sensitive to hydraulic conductivity, led us to say, let's do some pump tests, which the RCD is currently undertaking, on the Scott Valley floor. And the most important pump tests are going to be the ones that we do closest to the river, because that's the hydraulic conductivity that matters the most mm-hmm. to understanding the link between groundwater and the stream. Part of this is also to look at how much the assumption that the stream really penetrates the aquifer matters, because in fact the stream doesn't penetrate the aquifer very deeply. It's maybe dipping into the aquifer by a couple feet when the aquifer is actually 100 feet deep. And so effectively these lower hydraulic conductivity scenarios may be the more realistic ones. We've used this tool to look at what happens if we irrigate a lot in the spring when there's a lot of stream flows available. If we over-irrigate the crops, more so than currently is done, how does that affect late summer flows? And in some of these scenarios, we see a big reduction in how much water how much water the stream loses to groundwater. So the higher this curve, the more water is lost from the stream to groundwater. And with some of these scenarios where we irrigate a lot in the late spring, we save a lot of the losses later in the summer. So that's just an important tool to help guide us. So we have collected, just as a conclusion, we've collected some really a comprehensive database that feeds both the simplified tool that we're using to help guide our modeling efforts, and that also feeds the groundwater model itself. We've already used the data building effort to identify some additional data collection that's happening in the field, the saltwater budget measurements that we're doing in the field, the pumping tests that we're doing. And we've begun the process with the Groundwater Advisory Committee at the last meeting, where we went into a lot of depth about these scenarios, thinking about what kind of water management alternatives are there in the Scott Valley, what kind of groundwater management alternatives are there in the Scott Valley, what could work, what could not work, from an economic perspective, from a land ownership perspective, from a political perspective, and opening the door to brainstorming, and opening the door to people participating in the process of evaluating management, putting management practices on the table and say, can we try this management practice out in our simulation model and learn from the simulation model how that may or may not help future flows in the Scott River. With that, that's where we are. Over the next year, we hope to have this calibrated model together and develop these scenarios and implement these scenarios on this groundwater surface water modeling tool. And then with that, hopefully gain some information that will help us further guide field data collection efforts as we go down the road, and perhaps set in place some of these management tools as pilot projects. I don't imagine that these would be happening this year, but certainly where we can set up some assessment of which directions these pilots could go over the next couple of years. Thank you very much.
Questions for Dr. Herter?
I don't think so.
I was in Fort Jones when you presented this, I think initially to the community. Mm-hmm. And I recall that, you know, using the analogy of a cup, this is a basin, you said it today, that it's not an overdraft, that basically is depleted through the season to some extent. And then it refills. Is that a correct statement?
That's correct. So Descott Valley, I like to use the analogy of a cup or a flower pot, or even better, a bathtub that's filled with dirt. If you think of Descott Valley as a dirt-filled bathtub, with the mountains being the bathtub and connecting really under Descott Valley, and you got this dirt that's filling the Scott Valley. And on top of that, you have some have water users that have a net water use. Agriculture uses about 100,000 acre-feet per year, very roughly. But there are about 500,000 acre-feet of water generated in the watershed and flowing through the Scott River every year. And so there is, on the balance of it, plenty of water available. It's a distribution, it's a time distribution issue. It's that the Scott River has very low flows during the time period from about mid-July, when the snow melt is over in the mountains, until the first rains in October, November, and until the first frosts, when a lot of the riparian ET stops. And it's during that period where we have coho oversummering in the river, that have certain temperature needs, that have certain refuge needs, that have certain flow needs, that also need to be understood. And managing the water in that 2 to 3 months time frame is the most critical piece.
And it sounds like, too, though, that it's managing it in certain time and space, right? From your description of the sensitivity of a well that's maybe close to that river has a greater value than managing a well that is a mile back from the river.
That's right. That's exactly right. And that's part of what we can quantify with these tools that we're developing.
And there was, I believe, discussion at that time, as you kind of alluded to essentially artificially recharge by over-irrigating through the lower, through the spring season.
Exactly.
And pack that cup with as much water as you could get into it and basically bank it, right?
That's exactly right. So this is something that we've used this toolbox for. If you take the base case, which is sort of an average year, the net depletion, if it's above the zero line, or gain of groundwater to the river if it's below this black line, looks like this. So we have depletion mostly from about June until November. And I'm plotting the year from October through September, because hydrologists like to think of a year starting October 1 and going through the end of September. And that's just a hydrology quirk. If I take a scenario where I actually do a lot of spring recharge, and I reduce pumping in wells that have a very small delay time, let's the scenario 8A, I infect, actually this is the base scenario, not the thick black line, this is the base scenario. If I do that, I have, relative to the base scenario, on this gray line, this darker gray line, I stay in sort of river gaining mode much longer than this line, and I don't have much losses in June compared to the base case. So this is, and then it starts picking up then in July and August, but I still have about a 20-30% reduction in the losses from the river, which would, at least theoretically, in this very simplified case, translate into 20-30% more flows.
Can I ask you too, Dr. Harder, most of your depiction of the valley look to me like it's valley and basin, but in fact the watershed, because it picks up all these trips and everything else, and the basin itself is quite a lot bigger than just the basin itself.
That's right.
And that, in fact, there was discussion about some vegetation management within the basin that wasn't just vegetation as far as crop vegetation and rotation and that kind of stuff, but vegetation as far as native vegetation to get an ET. In fact, some of the folks had seen or had characterized, say, like the cedars, and there was some of that area that had really gotten abundant vegetation, and vegetation management was a tool potentially in the upper part of that basin that could potentially be a tool as well. So this gets much bigger than just a basin, flat bottom basin.
That's correct.
Type management.
And our efforts at this point are really focused on the flat part of the basin, not on the uphill side of the basin. The way the uphill side of the basin for us plays a role is through having fixed inputs on the tributaries that have either been measured or estimated based on the regression equations that we've developed. There is a separate effort that needs to happen at some point to look at the uplands and the watershed functioning in the uplands around the flat part of this basin, and look at issues of vegetation and how vegetation, for example, along the tributaries in the upper watersheds affect the flows in the tributaries, especially in the late spring and summer months.
I think it's so fascinating, too, to look at the connectivity that this model portrays between surface water, groundwater, and how it affects the gaining and loss of the stream, which is directly tied to that fish cycle and that migration cycle. That when you get to the end of September, October, you know, that's, I believe, when Chinook salmon are thinking about making their move.
That's right. That's right. And so one of the things that we hope to use the model for is also to say, can we estimate how many acre-feet of water, how many CFS of water we would need to put into the stream when it gets to really low flows? If there's a source of extra water that could be made available, you know, do we spring on that in mid-September, and how much should we put into the river? One potential scenario that we've tossed out, and I'm not mentioning this because it's politically feasible or not feasible, it's just a potential. The dredge tailings at the southern end of the valley, on the back of the envelope, looking at the size of it and the width of it and thinking about how deep it is, it probably holds somewhere on the order of 1,500, 2,000 acre-feet of water. And it's very coarse, big boulders.
Yeah.
It's water that could easily be pumped out and easily be recharged. You know, what about using that as a reservoir that could be pumped out in fall to augment stream flows, and so this tool will hopefully help us estimate water that even comes close to anything that would help, and what that would do to groundwater that's close to that dredge tailings in terms of drawing down that water table.
Well, you know, I just want to thank you and UC and all your work and your team's work to put together such a sophisticated model that can be used for kind of practical management here, right? That, I mean, I don't mean to say that this isn't, well, that it gets at some of the real baseline underlying hydrogeology and how this thing functions as a system, and then to be able to how to manage it for outcomes, not only to preserve the egg that's there and their use and right to land, but at the same time to time it and maybe think about how this works with stream function flow, anadromous fish migration, and those other needs as well.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of room to think creatively about how to manage the system and how to change current management practices in a way that meets the stakeholders' needs in more than one way.
Well, again, thank you, Thomas. I mean, from the standpoint of bringing the prestige of UC and the credibility of UC, I think it adds great credence to the process that's here. I think, you know, we're well aware of Scott Valley as far as just a community that has been a bit tough. And yet, you know, from hearing that, Brian, that the recent Groundwater meeting up there was, you know, you had people rolling up their sleeves over a model and talking this through. That's progress. And
I give them a lot of credit. People are very interested. They're very engaged.
Yeah.
And they're very smart.
Fantastic. Any comments or questions? Mr. Messer?
Dr. Harder, just so that I don't understand, your replenishment of groundwater almost appears as though it's an instantaneous thing. But my understanding is that groundwater takes a fair amount of time to go from the surface to
the groundwater table.
Depth is.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then we have a pool of water which may be relatively stagnant, and it's not going to be a mixing zone.
So right. So we have, for this simplified tool, we've ignored that. There is no, you're right, this is an instantaneous, once it leaves the root zone, we're thinking of this as an instantaneous replenishment of groundwater, which, you know, in the Scott Valley, where water table isn't really that deep, and at least in the central part of the Scott Valley, that's probably not that far off from reality. You know, it might be weeks. I don't think it's a whole lot more than a month. But still, it does potentially make a difference, and it's something that we can, when we get to the more three-dimensional, fully integrated groundwater surface water model, we could consider adding a delay time between when water leaves the root zone and when it actually gets to the groundwater table based on the depth to groundwater. And that's something we could implement certainly within the more complex model. This was just as a first cut, sort of doing the back of the envelope calculation to give us sort of an initial marching direction and an idea.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
I appreciate it. I don't have any speaker cards. Oh, you know what? Now that you say that, Rick, I do have one for you. Actually, I apologize. It was buried in my mix here.
Man's been sitting there all day.
He really has. Come on up, Rick.
Thank you. Do I have to sign one, or can I add on? Can I talk after Rick and then us?
Yeah, you could do that one. And just when you get, we'll take care of the paperwork as we're done here. So, yes, you can absolutely come in and say something and just identify yourself and take care of the paperwork on the backside. I don't mind that at all. Or it looks like you're going to do it anyway. Mr. Rick.
All right. Rick Costales. I'm the natural resource policy specialist for Siskiyou County. And we got another issue here where pretty technical, as you can see. I mean, this is pretty serious business, so it's obviously way over my head. And so my comments are going to be more rhetorical in nature, and I hope you can bear with me a little bit. But it's an important point that needs to be raised. Granted, Dr. Harder's work is great, but one of the things that you guys got to remember is the reason that he's working for us is the funding you guys provided. And from a strategic standpoint, that support of the community to help understand these issues and try and figure out what's actually going on is huge. You know, I got to say about, you know, Brian's comment about how surprised he was to be able to sit down with a bunch of ranchers and actually have everybody try and figure out what's going on and be civil and scratch their heads and all that over the period of controversial times. He's had some rough times, no doubt about it. But a lot of that has to do with the attitude that people bring to where they approach into this stuff. Trust is the issue. And Mark Lancaster mentioned to me earlier when I first met him about 15 years ago that I didn't trust him. And I said, well, no, it's not that I didn't trust you. I didn't. But I didn't not trust you either. The jury was out on that. I was up and on the fence riding on this about whether trust is something that you build and you develop over time. And it's a very important relationship. And I look at Heidi's probably seen this movie, and maybe some of you have too, but it's a documentary PBS did on the Dust Bowl that they showed. And it shows those guys plowing with their horses in dust that has to be about that deep, and they're planting tree seedlings. Now, if you can imagine somebody in Oklahoma with somebody from the government coming up with a tree and saying, I want you to plant this tree in that sand dune. How are you going to get that guy to do it? You get that with the partner saying, hey, we got a common problem here. We got to figure out what's going on, and we got to see how it works. You can't come in with a ticket book or, you know, threats or the perception that you're coming in here and come hell or high water, you're going to be making people do things that they don't understand. I recall along a similar line when Troy Fletcher, and I think, Mike, you might have been there where they come earlier, I think it was around 2000, something like that, to meet with the farmers and talk about water, and everybody met to come see what the tribes have to say. And I think Troy dang near said it in exactly these words, you guys can go easy or you can go hard, but you're going our way. Mm-hmm. And when you tell a bunch of farmers that, and you tell a bunch of people like that, that don't go over very good. You know, Troy and I laugh about it now, and I think he, you know, it was maybe could have used another approach, but and we're working on building a good relationship with the Yurok and everything like that, so it's just a stage in development. But you know, the farmers are going to say, well, let's try hard. You know, we'll go hard. I don't know this going your way, but we're going to see how it goes. And when they say go hard, it doesn't mean we're going to fight, but you know, we're going to make we need to understand these issues, and we're gonna get to the bottom of do you really understand what you think you know, and if you do, convince us. And thanks to your funding on this and somebody like Dr. Harder, who's been sitting down with people in that valley who recognize the problem but appreciate the approach of saying, look, let's understand this stuff. And before we start doing all these things and zigging and zagging here, we need to understand what actually it is we're talking and how these things work. So I can't thank you guys enough for supporting that financially. The farmers, I already I know they've, you know, there's stuff Dr. Harder's found they just as soon not have heard. But it is what it is because there's trust there. And there's a relationship that's been built up. And I think with Brian, I think that, you know, that relation is being built. And with some of these other agencies, we need to do the same thing. But with regard to some of the technical issues in terms of, you know, convincing people yet, and Dr. Harder's model, you saw the little graph where he had where long about 79, I think, was the drought, and all of a sudden the flows went a lot lower than they had historically. Well, a lot of those east side ephemeral streams have the same situation where there's no groundwater pumping. You know, that my flows, if somebody were to measure a gauge since about 1979, have had the same thing. I used to trout fish in my place year round. And now the streams, it's still not flowing. After that drought, Creek never flowed for 2 years. It's never come back. And and that is the case for all those streams. There was something happened in 79 that, you know, drained stuff. And then that upland veg, I'm sure you guys have heard about those things in the upland veg. You know, when, you know, we first moved there, you could get around on the hillsides, and now you got to crawl on your belly like a reptile to go chase after deer. And so, you know, there's a lot of changes, and it's not just irrigation. And we need to really find out the link of the irrigation to, to all of these stuff, because there's a lot of variables that, you know, that could explain the same sort of phenomenon. But again, I appreciate that. Oh, and I gave you guys a copy of the Siskiyou County groundwater Scott Valley groundwater management plan. What the Board of Supervisors did, we got 7 aquifers, or excuse me, maybe 9 aquifers in Siskiyou County, and what the board wanted to do was to allow each of the, you know, the best people to decide how to, you know, what needs to be done and advise the board on those sorts of issues is the local community. So they're going to create local groundwater management councils that are going to advise the boards. The Scott Valley one is the first. The idea is to engage the citizens, have them put their heads on this thing, work on this, advise the board on what sort of policies the county needs to adopt relative to groundwater and what sort of things need to be done. And so from my experience, to sort of, it's the first one, I think it's going really well. The board's commitment is to, obviously, in that thing, you'll see it's voluntary actions. The first step in a voluntary action is to find out what's going on, and there is a full-bore commitment to do that as much as funding, and we can find people to help do it. Thank you.
Thank you, Rick. Appreciate it very much. All right, Michael Belchick.
Good afternoon. I'll be mercifully short. It's 5 o'clock now. So my name is Michael Belchick, and I'm a senior fisheries biologist for the Yurok tribe. And I've worked for them for about 17 years now. And what I work on is flow issues and dam removal on the Klamath River. And so first of all, I just wanted to say a few comments. Like, first of all, I wanted to say this is a really good job. Trying to understand these issues on the Scott River is really important to the Yurok tribe, because the tribe catches a lot of fish at the mouth river of the river, and the fish are the great integrator of the whole basin. So what happens on the Scott affects the Yurok tribe all the way at the mouth of the river in a real way. The couple things I wanted to know was that I found the presentation to be really fascinating, and I had a million questions for Dr. Harder, and I lack basic understanding of exactly what it is they've done. And so I definitely like to continue this dialogue. And that brings me to the next one. I think it's really important because this affects us that I'd like to understand what the opportunities are for data review, for review of the data sets, the assumptions, the modeling process, and things like that. It's not because I think it's wrong or I think that I don't trust Dr. Harder or anything like that. It's really just about due diligence because this does affect the tribe and it's my job to review these things. And right now, I don't know. I don't know whether I'm allowed to look at well logs or whether I can look at the modeling process or could I ask for a scenario to be run or anything like that. And then that brings me to those two things really get to the third issue, which is the issue of stakeholders. So I know that there's been a lot of talk about stakeholders, and I think it's really important that there be a way to involve in a scientific and a review way the tribe from downriver. I know that there was on the slide it said there was some dialogue with the tribes, especially when I see in the presentation that scenarios are being drawn up and vetted as to feasibility of doing and things like that. I think there may be different ideas depending on where you look at, different ideas scientifically and things like that. And we'd definitely like to have some input on that. And but overall, I was really impressed with the effort. It really looks like it's contributing to the overall understanding of the Scott.
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it. Dr. Harder, can I ask you maybe to come back and just address the issue of the model itself? It sounds like the model may not be all the way done, that it's still in process, but how about the fact of public dissemination or use of that information?
No, those are excellent questions. Thank you, Michael. We promised Brian that we would have the data collection part, sort of the GIS database piece that led to the water budget model and the water budget model analysis together by the end of the month, and I think we're going to have that ready sometime in February to be disseminated publicly, and then that will explain a lot of the analysis that's been done on the input data, as well as explain some of the stream flow depletion analysis that we've done. We just submitted the stream flow depletion analysis with this water budget model to a scientific journal for review, and I can disseminate it. I don't know that it can be posted on our website at this point since it's going to a journal, but I can certainly make that available. That's not an issue at all. The groundwater model is not going. That's under development, and we'll publish that as it comes along. But I think the much more important question is the question of developing these scenarios, and I certainly have a big interest in making sure that everybody who is at the table, and that includes the tribes, has input to that. This is a great opportunity to try out all kinds of different hats and see whether they fit or not fit. And that's what this is really for. And so what I'll take away from Michael's comment is that we need to think about how to potentially do a formal process, or at least make sure that as we develop this, everybody who wants to have input or wants to give input to that process has the opportunity to give that input over the next 6 months.
Sounds great.
One more quick question, Dr. Harder. Just a clarification, and for the groundwater model, you're still out collecting information, or maybe one more season on hydraulic conductivity, soil moisture, and ET, just to, because you've made some basic assumptions in what you presented today, and that just fine tunes it to complete the groundwater model.
So we're going to complete this next round of the groundwater. We had an initial sort of preliminary version of the groundwater model that Ryan Hines did for his master's thesis, but then he never wrote up his master's thesis, which was unfortunate because he got a consulting job and had other things to do. But we've refined from that. I mean, we've learned a lot from his work, and we've refined and we pulled that back together, and that's going to be all part of what we're going to give to Brian in the next month. We will calibrate this model with the data that we have, and then I foresee that there will be a next step with this data collection that's ongoing on the field water budget and understanding both the ET of alfalfa and the irrigation of alfalfa, where we can hopefully And partly perhaps with this modeling or supported by looking at the model and saying, does the model tell us maybe something about how this ought to fit together? If the pieces don't quite fit, maybe the model can tell us how to fit the pieces together in a unique way. And we can test that then in the field. So this is going to be a back and forth process. And this is not going to be the last version of the model. I think it's a start, and then we're going to go from there. And that'll be a back and forth between doing the field work and doing modeling work, maybe doing some submodels that also look at temperature data and look at it at a much smaller scale, you know, kind of zoom into a particular location where we can do some field experiments in the future. The pumping tests that the RCD is doing, I'm helping them a little bit just sort of on the design of that. We do some this winter. They're best done this time of the year when nobody else is pumping. I think we're going to do one, maybe even two more seasons of data collection on the ET and soil moisture, depending on how it goes this year. I mean, if this year looks exactly like last year, we'll probably can say, okay, I think we collected enough data. Steve Orloff has put together an excellent presentation that he's given to a number of people at a number of occasions in the Scott Valley and elsewhere that specifically talks to that work in there. It'll be a back and forth process.
Do you know if many of those wells need to be pump tested when they're installed? So are they on file with DWR? Or
there's no mandate to pump test. I mean, a lot of them will do a pump test just to figure out what kind of pump they need to put on,
what kind of yield they get, just do
a short pump test. Okay. And some of that is in the DWR records.
Yeah.
And in fact, actually, the Karuk tribe, on their modeling efforts in their report, they've actually used some of those data and compiled that in their report.
Great. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you very much for coming and your work.
Yeah, and maybe just to add to that, to the dialogue that I work both with the Quartz Tribe environmental coordinator and I've worked with in the process of the Karuk Tribe developing their model. We've had an ongoing dialogue with their consultant, so that's all there.
Fantastic, thank you. I think we're good, huh? Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you for that information, Adam. That was fantastic. Okay, we've got two very short things. Board member request.